Flight 3407 showed us what's wrong. What would it really take to solve these problems? I'm Paul Platt, and this is Aero News. Welcome in to the Aero News special feature, and thanks for downloading us today. My guest today is Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot, and of Bob Miller Flight Training in the Buffalo, New York area. We're talking today, or extending a conversation we started yesterday, about the transcript that was released last week of the final moments of Flight 3407 that came down on approach to Buffalo Niagara International Airport back in February. And Bob, yesterday we, just to summarize for our listeners, we talked about a number of factors that were not involved that were initially picked up by the media, among them crew fatigue, training issues at the regional airlines and things. Icing was not thought to be a significant factor, and moved on to what is a significant factor. And in your mind, that is deficiencies in training that started out during primary training for these pilots and were never resolved all the way through their ascent to the point where they were sitting in an airliner cockpit. I guess what we need to move on to is, what needs to change? Do we need more regulation? Do we need just some common sense or some balance in between? What do we need to make sure that this kind of thing doesn't happen again?
Well, for years, Paul, our industry leaders are leading us to believe that these are acceptable losses. And when I say acceptable losses, we're suffering 250 fatal accidents a year in the United States. And we're told that, hey, stuff happens. Relax, Bob. There's nothing we can do about it. Similarly, we're told that most of our accidents result from a maneuvering phase of flight, flying too slowly, inability to maneuver the airplane low and slow to the ground. This is where our accidents take place. But we hear no call from our industry leaders, and I refer specifically to those who speak for us as an industry. I refer to AOPA and Air Safety Foundation, to some extent EAA. I don't hear an outrage. I don't hear any attention being called to what are we doing to change the practical test standards to deal with our deficiencies in maneuvering flight. I don't hear for any additional emphasis being placed on stall training, for example, or slow flight training. We see students being introduced to stall training, and they're brought into incipient stalls. They make a quick recovery, and then we move on through the course of study. You know, learning to fly is expensive, no question about that. And the more time we spend in training, the higher it costs, the more it costs. So I believe we do need to extend the curriculum. I do believe we need to enrich in the curriculum. But at the same time, we have our industry leaders trying to make flying more affordable, making it easier for people to obtain their licenses. You know, I'm a great advocate of the Sport Pilot Program. I teach it in my school, but it seems ludicrous to me how the standard for training could be lowered from 40 hours to 20 hours. This is a clear and deliberate way to bring more people into the system and to make it more affordable. But the downside of that is COGA 3407. Once the public reaches an outrage that these accidents are totally unacceptable, I think that outrage, if it finds its way to the Congress and from the Congress to the administration and from the administration to the FAA, at that time, I believe there will be significant change in the design of the curriculum. Right now, it hasn't happened. Another COGA 3407, perhaps. But this accident, once the probable cause is actually published in it, shows the public that this was a direct and unequivocal fault of the pilots on board that airplane, and then we can trace those faults and those deficiencies back to their original training, then something will be done.
Well, Bob, it occurs to me that if we fix the problem at the point of original training, we'd solve one of the other big problems, and that is the disparity in the accident rate between the airlines and general aviation, because while they happen very rarely and are horrific when they do and get all the headlines, it really is pretty rare that we have an airliner go down, especially, you know, in a situation like this. However, we have, you know, almost every week we have a fatal accident in general aviation. And if we took that end of the training chain to address the problems, if they are training related, then we would also clear up a lot of smaller accidents that happen in GA.
We absolutely must do that. You know, there is a cause and effect, and we trace this back to the primary grades. In school, when Johnny can't read, when he graduates from high school, when Johnny can't fly, it's traceable back right to the first, second, and third grade. That has to change. When Colgan 3407 went in, that was a tipping point. And I am still surprised that our general aviation industry hasn't come forth and said to among themselves, hey, listen, something happened there that's traceable back to our end of the spectrum. We absolutely must do something about this. And Paul, unfortunately, it's not happening. When it's going to happen, how it's going to happen, we know what needs to be done, but making it happen is going to make flying more expensive, both to learn how to fly and even the traveling public, you know, who are outraged at the low salaries that the Colgan crew were making. You know, well, if you want to have, you know, a Sullenberg type of skill up front, you can't have a bus driver salary up front. You know, so there's a whole range of issues that need to be addressed. But it's time now that we sit around the table and have a summit, a general aviation summit, and relook at what it is that we're doing to ourselves.
Well, Bob, we're going to take a break here, but before we do, I want to point out that that a union bus driver in most transit systems in major American cities get paid more than regional airline pilots starting out in the right seat do. But anyway, that aside, when we come back from the break, I want to enter an imaginary world where we're not even going to make you head of the FAA, Bob. We're going to anoint you and give you a scepter and a crown, and we're going to let you fix this in a perfect world. Bob Miller is my guest. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Paul Plack, and you're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
Uncramp your style in a new Citation CJ2 Plus from Cessna. Now with integrated ProLine 21 avionics, FADEC, and a restyled cockpit and cabin. In the CJ2 Plus, you'll carry more payload than you could in the original CJ2. You'll climb and cruise faster. You'll have the freedom to use even shorter runways. And you'll do it all on less fuel. For a sure thing, call 1-800 for Cessna.
Diamond's DA-42 Twin Star is general aviation's ultimate flying machine. Fly fast with the confidence of a twin for the cost of a single. Go direct over water or rugged terrain and cover great distances in the first and only piston aircraft with an advanced airframe, avionics, and engines. The DA-42 gives you options you've never had before, including the Garmin G1000 and no ice protection. Go where you want, when you want, fast and for less. Visit Diamond on the web at www.diamondair.com or call 888-359-3220.
Welcome back to the Aero News special feature. I'm Paul Platt, talking today with Bob Miller about Flight 3407 and the transcript of the cockpit voice recorder that was released finally by the NTSB last week. Some lessons learned, maybe some things to look for in the future. And Bob, we're going to go on a limb here. I'm not sure I'll like the world we create when we do this, but it'll be an interesting intellectual exercise. So you are now the sole arbiter of all the FAR affecting training. What would be the perfect world for someone not only to enter the general aviation world as a recreational flyer, but what would be the same and what would be different if that person was instead on a career track for an airline?
Paul, that's an excellent question, and I feel privileged to have an ability or an opportunity to comment on that.
Well, I knew you'd like the scenario, Bob.
Number one, rather than totally indicting our general aviation community and what we do have checks and balances. We have something called check rides. We cannot solo a student without a check ride. A private pilot, instrument pilot, commercial pilots, they all receive check rides long before they get into the airlines. Now, when an individual fails a check ride, that individual has a responsibility to report that information on a job application for which he's seeking a position as a professional pilot. In the case of Renslow, the fact that they went unreported, in my opinion, should be more than just grounds for termination. It should be grounds for criminal punishment. Failure to disclose this information on a professional pilot application should be grounds for criminal enforcement, not just administrative enforcement. That alone would have hopefully precluded that falsification of information on the part of Renslow to the airline. So all of us pilots who go out there and work and train, if we fail a check ride, it's going to be made a matter of your personal record when you apply for a position on an airline. That's number one, and that's something that, of course, needs to be done. But number two, before being granted a private pilot, a privilege to fly passengers in the national airspace system, much more attention needs to be devoted to the individual's true ability to fly. And I mean looking at their maneuvering ability, looking at the ability to operate an airplane in slow flight, looking at an ability to operate an airplane in crosswinds. These things are not being adequately covered in the private pilot syllabus, which, by the way, still remains at 40 hours, and it's been that since the late 40s. We need to enrich the syllabus and the requirements to qualify as a private pilot, and that should be increased all the way up through instrument and commercial. The PTS and Part 61, and I know my pilot colleagues are going to just be gritting their teeth as I say this, but we need to look at Part 61. If we need to open it up and redefine the qualifications and the requirements to become a licensed pilot, then that needs to be done. Those are just a couple of starters that we need to work with.
Okay, now what about some of the things that wouldn't require any more hours but are just kind of absent from the PTS? We're not required to maybe be as aggressive as many safety proponents believe in things like training for stalls or spins or that sort of thing. And some of that stuff has actually been removed over the years.
Well, yes, the spin training has been removed. And we seem to make it easier and easier to become a flight instructor. And we make it easier and easier to retain our certificates as a flight instructor. Shortly after I became a flight instructor, I took some serious aerobatic training, learning how to recover from unusual attitudes. That dramatically changed my perspective on flying an airplane and what to do in extremely unusual attitudes. For me, I think that should be made a mandatory part of the CFI requirements that they undergo. All CFIs undergo some sort of formal aerobatic instruction just so they know how to deal with an airplane when it's operating inadvertently outside of its operating envelope. We're teaching CFIs to instruct people on instrument flight who themselves have never been in instrument conditions. This is abhorrent to me, how we can continue to allow this to take place. Our flight instructors are at the bottom end of the food chain. In other endeavors, like even something like scuba diving, the scuba instructor's at the top end of the food chain. You know, primacy of learning, the things that we teach and learn at the primary level carry forth all the way through our flying career, and as 3407 proved, some of the basic, most basic elements of instruction, the things we should have learned, if not learned properly then, can have a horrible impact on us later on, and unfortunately when we're carrying a bunch of passengers with us.
I hate to even go to this next spot, Bob, but I have to ask, because I think one of the reasons that training is not more aggressive, and many of your direct competitors, as an example, in your region, don't train as aggressively in clouds and crosswinds and things as you try to do at your school, is because of their concern about liability and the concern about explaining to the guy who leased him back a 172 why it's no longer flyable and that sort of thing. Do we need to shield flight schools in terms of tort reform from frivolous lawsuits in order to get them to go out on these limbs?
Well, I don't think that the kind of training that I'm advocating is any more risky than what we're doing. I have flight instructors in my school that pay twice the prevailing wage to. We're paying $35 an hour when neighboring flight schools are paying flight instructors $23 an hour. This gives us a much better, more qualified flight instructor who's capable of doing this kind of training in these kinds of regimes. Now, when a flight school is their only alternative is to hire a brand new flight instructor fresh out of school, paying him $12 or $13 an hour. If I was operating that flight school, I wouldn't want that flight instructor going out and doing deep stalls or accelerated stalls or cross-control stalls. The kid's barely wet behind the ears himself. So what we need to do is have flight schools pony up, pay a decent prevailing wage to flight instructors, hire only qualified, experienced flight instructors, and then with that, conduct the kind of training that I'm advocating, and the risks will not be any higher. Another thing that we see happening is this rapid emergence of flight training devices, simulators. They're patterning themselves after airlines that are using $38 million level D simulators. We're now seeing a proliferation of simulators in the flight schools for primary and instrument training. You know, these simulators are wonderful for teaching procedures, how to get into and out of a hold. But when students are taken into the simulator, every time the winds kick up above 18 knots or every time the ceiling drops below 600 feet, this is just simply denying the student an opportunity to learn the kind of flying that he needs to do. I mean, this was evident in 3407. Here is a first officer, never been in ice before, yet is assigned to fly in icing routes. That individual, in the incapacitation of a captain, has to be fully qualified and experienced to operate that airplane in the conditions in which it's flying. This clearly wasn't the case. Was this Colgan's fault? Perhaps. Perhaps crew scheduling would have said, no, if we're going to fly into Buffalo in December or February, we ought to have more experienced pilots, but I'm not sure any airline scheduling program is that precise.
Well, Bob, I always leave these things feeling that we've not solved the world's problems, but maybe made a dent. And I guess if we make people think, that's good too, and would remind them that if they want to respond, they can reach me through email at paulp, P-A-U-L-P, at aero-news.net. And I'm sure there'll be more to come from this flight and more to learn, Bob, and we'll look forward to talking to you about it more in the future.
Thanks, Bob.
You can read Bob's monthly newsletter at www.overtheairwaves.com. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.